St. Benedict come to join us this evening, but in a sense, that's not regrettable, because there'll be no deficiency in presentation, because the speaker we do have, Masiku Kujapa, is an expert in the field, and I'm sure we'll learn a lot tonight. Masiku is currently the senior researcher at UCT's Law, Race and Gender Unit, as well as being active politically in the New Democratic Left Front. He has worked extensively in human rights advocacy and the NGO community on issues ranging from HIV/AIDS, community and public education, community development, local government transformation, the promotion of cooperatives, alternative economic transformation, financial sector transformation, social and economic justice, land and agrarian reforms. The list of organizations and their acronyms are lengthy, and perhaps I can just direct you to the Law, Race and Gender's Unit's website for those. Masiku also holds his MPhil in Land and Agrarian Studies and a BSc in Mechanical Engineering from the University of Natal. I'd like to do a brief introduction to situate the issue of land reform in the earlier lectures that we've had and the themes that we're trying to develop through the course of this week. So the first of these is the role of law and the rule of law when it comes to land reform. And it's to start with a very obvious proposition, but it's often astounding to people when they actually think about it, which is without law, we wouldn't have property rights. Property rights are entirely a legal construct. The notion that land belongs to someone, the monarch, the church, an individual, a chief, a community, individuals or collectives, and then what sits below that right of ownership to exploit the mineral wealth that may be underneath the surface, to farm it for agricultural purposes, to build a home, to use it for commercial purposes. These are all regulated by law, but they're in fact created by law. And similarly, the question of land reform is being done through law. We know that law was used to dispossess of land. So, I mean, beginning in the colonial era, just very briefly, I mean, in 1658, legislation was passed where the Khoi were informed they could no longer dwell to the west of the Salt and Lesbian Rivers. In the 1800s, the British and Boer governments proclaimed reserves. Then we had the Native Land Act of 1913, which restricted the area of land for lawful African occupation, stripped African tenants and sharecroppers of their land, and replaced these with labor tenants. Then obviously we know about forced removals under apartheid, the establishment of homeland, where you could live, what land you could own, was determined by the passage of legislation. And then of course the Group Areas Act, which completed the apartheid land. And it also connects with the other theme that we've discussed of lawfare and politics and the separation of powers and the tension between the courts and the executive and the legislature. So some of the tensions that we see between those branches of government and their respective roles in trying to achieve the social and economic goal of land reform plays out the theory of lawfare, of displacing politics into the courts and making judges adjudicate on these disputes. Dennis touched on them last night in the eviction and occupiers cases, where what was considered an absolute right of ownership and your ability to evict people, the courts reconfigured that right and said, only if there's somewhere else for people to live, only if you've consulted them, and put obligations on local government to provide emergency measures. And this tension obviously also brings to the fore the attacks on the judiciary that we see where they're considered to be counter-revolutionary, and the glacial pace at which land reform is proceeding in this country. To the extent some of those frustrations are because of the process that was adopted, which is a very legalistic process, and therefore has all the obstacles obstacles and delays attendant with litigation, with having to pursue a legal claim in that way, as opposed to some other political process. We see all of those challenges playing out. Now, the right to property and land and the foundation constitutionally for the Land Reform Project is set out in Section 25, and I'm quite sure Ms. Ibuko is going to deal with all of those issues as we move through this evening. But I'd like to read you a passage from a very useful piece of work by Cheryl Walker entitled The Limits to Land Reform, Reviewing the Land Question. And it's an example which just illustrates the complexity of the land question. It arises from the Bongazi land claim on the eastern shores of Lake Zambezia in KZN, which is now part of the Wetland Park that was proclaimed there. And this is how she summarizes the issue. The claim pitted against each other two very different local histories of how the eastern shores first came to be settled and by whom, along with two very different interpretations, both based on the same genealogy, of the constitution of clan identity and political authority in the area since the 19th century. One set of clan and representatives described an isolated, self-sufficient, and autonomous coastal clan whose only interest was to return to the land from which they had been gradually but inexorably displaced by a combination of state forestry and conservation authorities over two decades in the mid-20th century. Another set of representatives articulated a confident tribal sovereignty that drew on both apartheid and pre-colonial discourses of tribal identity and clan hierarchies for its legitimacy. They claimed ownership of the eastern shores not for settlement purposes alone, but to control the mineral wealth, which was titanium, that glistened in its dunes. The views of the people who were represented by these two violent and hostile sets of spokesmen, they were all men, are more difficult to reconstruct. Since the mid-1950s, the 400 or 500 households that once made up the population of the eastern shores have been fragmented and dispersed across a number of neighboring communities. They have not been, for many years, a bounded, clearly identifiable group with a single relationship to their ancestral land. The survey of preferred settlement options that the Land Claims Commission conducted in 1998 indicated that if required to choose between land and financial compensation, the overwhelming majority of those canvassed would opt for money. However, the survey was conducted at a particular moment in the history of the claim when the opportunity to resettle on the land or lease it for mining appeared already foreclosed to many claimants. And it's always difficult to disentangle preferences and pragmatics in such polls. In the late 80s and early 90s, the different interpretations of past and present at the local level were yoked to competing external visions for development of the eastern shores. Local residents of the area, extending beyond the small number of households who once lived on this spit of land, found themselves divided over and ultimately subordinated to larger national and even international interests, for whom the competing land claims provided both complications and opportunities. On the one hand, there were major mining interests, which defended the chief who claimed the land. On the other hand, there were conservationists who argued for the protection of the wetlands and dunes against both mining and human settlement, as in the best and broadest public interest. This group looked for most favor on those among the former residents who were prepared to articulate their opposition to the tribal authority. In 1996, after some hesitation, the ANC government decided in favor of conservation/ecotourism rather than mining as the development strategy for the eastern shores, the benefits of which were intended not only for those who claimed it as their land, but for a larger community, undefined but encompassing all of the impoverished regions, residents of the wider region. The land claim was finally settled 3 years later, after an intensive process of research, conflict management, and negotiation, which resulted in an agreement that combined financial compensation for former residents with the establishment of community trust with a stake in the future development of the park. Implementation of the agreement as of 2003 was still in its infancy, so that's 5 years later. Tensions continue to swirl around the trust leadership, although the violence of the early negotiations phase has receded. A major challenge facing the trust is how best to manage and disperse to its dispersed members in a developmentally sound manner the funds from park operations that are beginning to accumulate in its account. while the trustees are being drawn into co-management activities with the park as representative of, quote, the community, the difficulties of including former residents in processes of consultation and representation remain. People who are aggrieved that they were excluded from the financial payout complain about the premises on which the settlement was based. High entrenched levels of poverty and unemployment in the region mean that the mining option still has a lurking local appeal. The complexity and the enormous range of issues that you can see at play, just one example. And the statistics tell us that 69,000 claims were lodged with the Land Claims Commission between 1995 and 1998. And I've just described the complexity and the difficulties with respect to one of those. So this is the challenge of land reform in South Africa. And with a reference to this fine publication which someone handed me last night, the Claremont Rondebosch People's Post, the newspaper of record, which on its front page for this week talks about a proposed takeover of the Rondebosch Common this weekend. This is to be undertaken in order to call for the development of open spaces and the scrapping of range layers for those occupied council properties, as well as the demand for the city to transfer ownership of its rental units to the tenants. One of the organizers said that the occupation of Rondebosch Common is symbolic of all spaces in affluent areas which are underutilized, while, quote, people on the Cape Flats don't have space to move. The coming together of civil society organizations reminds us of the day of United Democratic Action in taking forward the struggle. We've once again reached the point of building a united front, this time to rid ourselves of the divide between rich and poor. The common is a stark reminder of this barrier dividing us. It's a public open space which is hardly ever used by the rich to walk their dogs. This is happening while the poor are living on top of each other, only a few suburbs away. Those with money have the luxury of acres of land at their disposal. It's about time the spatial inequality is properly challenged. Cape Town is still as divided as it was during the apartheid era. Poor live a different life compared to those in privileged areas. These areas have hectares of manicured lawns used for golf courses and other luxuries, while there's a desperate need for land to be developed in order to provide housing for people who've been on waiting lists for years. It's time that these areas were integrated. With that, I'd like to turn tonight's discussion over to Mr. Bupo, and then we'll open up to the floor for discussion and comment.
And no law may permit arbitrary deprivation of property. Two, property may be expropriated only in terms of law of general application. A, for public purpose or in the public interest. And B, subject to compensation, the amount of which and the time and manner of payment of which have either been agreed to by those affected or decided or approved by a court. Three, the amount of the compensation and the time and manner of payment must be just and equitable, reflecting an equitable balance between the public interest and the interests of those affected, having regard to all relevant circumstances, including A, the current use of the property, B, the history of the acquisition and use of the property, C, the market value of the property, D, the extent of direct state investment and subsidy in the acquisition and beneficial capital improvement of the property, and the E, the purpose of the expropriation. The property clause goes on to say, for the purpose of this section, that is section 25, the public interest includes the nation's commitment to land reform and to reforms to bring about equitable access to all South Africa's natural resources. And property is not limited to land. Five, the state must take reasonable legislative and other measures within its available resources to foster conditions which enable citizens to gain access to land on an equitable basis. Six, a person or community whose tenure of land is legally insecure as a result of past racial discriminatory laws or practices is entitled to the extent provided by the Act of Parliament either to tenure, which is legally secure, or to comparable redress. Seven, a person or community dispossessed of property after 19 June 1913 as a result of past racial discriminatory laws or practices is entitled either to restitution of that property or to equitable redress. Eight, no provision of this section may impede the state from taking legislative and other measures to achieve land, water, and related reform in order to redress the results of past racial discrimination, provided that any departure from the provisions of this section is in accordance with the provisions of the Limitations Clause. The Limitations Clause is in section 36 of the Constitution. I'll explain it just now. Parliament, find the final subsection of section 25. Parliament must enact the legislation referred to secure the rights of a community of people whose tenure of land is insecure. The Limitations Clause in the Constitution basically says that the rights in the Bill of Rights may be limited, including the right to property. But that limitation may only take place in terms of a law that applies to everyone, a law of general application. To the extent that such a limitation will be reasonable, will be justifiable in an open and democratic society. When government or parliament enacts such a law, it must take into account a number of factors according to section 36. The nature of the right, the importance of the purpose of the limitation, the nature and extent of the limitation, the relation between the limitation and its purpose, and whether there could have been other less restrictive means to achieve the same purpose, rather than limiting the right as described in the Bill of Rights. Now, I thought that was an important start to refer in full to section 25. I've also fallen into the trap of referring to it as a property clause, which I think in our debate in South Africa is actually an unfortunate situation, because this clause, more than anything, is actually a mandate for land reform. It is not actually a mandate to protect property rights above everything else. What happened after the adoption of the Constitution? was government adopting the so-called willing buyer, willing seller principle. In other words, land can only exchange hands for the purposes of land reform if there's a willing buyer, that is government by and large, who engages and reaches an agreement with a willing seller on the open market. That is the policy that has informed land reform from 1994 up to about 2009, I would say up to today, because there's not been any significant change. Now, Agri South Africa, the Democratic Alliance, media commentators have us believe that the willing buyer, willing seller principle is mandated by the Constitution. No reading of Section 25 can lead to such a conclusion. For whatever reason, this assumption is quite dominant. And on the left, where I belong politically, this assumption leads to frequent lamentation, and on the right, to a celebration that property rights are absolutely protected in the Constitution. It's useful to reread, therefore, and analyze what this Section 25 says. 25.1, when it says no one may be deprived of property except in terms of law, it's quite correct. There must be a law-based approach to property. What that law says is something else. A law-based approach to property does not mean an absolute projection of property rights. It just means that property rights must be governed by a process of law. And that governing of property rights by a process of law may even include a process of deprivation of property rights in terms of a number of other factors, which I think Section 25 puts out in full. 25.2 allows for expropriation, no matter what noise Juju is making. He apparently does not understand what our Constitution is saying. In fact, I would argue that very few in government and in the ANC understand what the Constitution provides for in this regard. It does not only allow for expropriation, but it also sets very clear conditions for how that expropriation may take place. It must be for a public purpose, it must meet the public interest. What is most interesting for me is the provision for compensation. That provision for compensation says the amount of the compensation may be agreed to by those affected or decided or approved by a court. But also, very importantly, it says it must be just and equitable, reflecting an equitable balance between the public interest and the interest of those affected. Now, the challenge, in my view, in this regard, lies in what the law may describe or define as just and equitable, and what that balance would be. In over and above what the law may provide for, the courts themselves interpreting the meaning of just and equitable, as well as what that equitable balance would provide for. Another element that's quite interesting, and I think very useful for redistributive land reform, is actually about the time and manner of payment. Why should we assume that payment has to be cash, has to be immediate? Our policy insists that compensation must be cash and immediate. It's an absolute, I would say, mistake to actually have such a provision in our law, which our Constitution actually goes over and above. With reference to history, in Taiwan, after the Americans basically put a government after the Chinese Revolution of 1949, what was interesting, not just Taiwan, Singapore, South Korea, and a number of those East Asian states which the U.S. was basically controlling, there the U.S. insisted on compensation for land reform. Not a compensation which was not cash, but rather compensation which was to take place over time. How was this to take place in those cases? They basically gave shares to publicly owned companies in Taiwan and Singapore and South Korea to the farmers who expropriated. And therefore, then over time, they could get their compensation, whilst at the same time they were being tied back to the local economy, so that there's not actually a case of capital flight. Why did we not look at a solution such as that? Why did we have to insist on cash compensation? Even though the Constitution actually allows us to consider something, perhaps such as Taiwan has tried. The other important element, thinking critically about Section 25, has to do with what determines the land of the amount of the compensation. Unfortunately, our policy insists that only the market value must be considered first and foremost. What then worsened the situation in this regard was a judgment by Judge Brendan Hayes at the Land Claims Court, I think it was in the late 90s, where he, in his judgment, basically emphasized and underlined that only market value may be considered in determining the amount of compensation for expropriation. That's unfortunate. That's an unfortunate precedent, because then, since then, most considerations and judgments of the Land Claims Court have relied on the Gelder Hayes formula, which basically puts market value as the primary basis for determining the amount to pay for compensation. Whereas subsection 3 of section 25 is very clear. It lists five conditions: the history of the acquisition, the use of the property, the extent of state subsidies, and so on. And a careful legal reading of that subsection clearly shows that those five conditions are not a closed list. It's actually an open-ended list. There could be a number of other factors that could be brought into account in determining the amount of compensation. For example, commercial farms in our country have all been acquired one way or another from a form of historic dispossession, as the citation that Michelle has written of that 1658 law. Commercial farms have all benefited from general state subsidies in the 20th century and other assistance that was paid for by public money over a prolonged period. Many of them, until the late 90s, were heavily indebted to the land bank and other public financial institutions. And there was also, in the mid-90s, quite a lot of available land that was underutilized in the commercial farms. So why should our policy compensation then put the market value of land as the determining factor, determining the amount of compensation? And why are courts following blindly the formula set by Gelder Hayes, even though that formula set by Gelder Hayes actually falls far short of what the Constitution provides for? In this regard, I think our courts are failing the mandate of land reform as given to us in Section 25. I think the courts are following the publicly dominant bias of reading Section 25 as a property clause and not as a mandate for land reform. I will not go through any other analysis. I will engage in debate on further analysis of what Section 25 provides for. Well, I like so there's a few notes here that I think are critical. Section 4B says property, 25.4B says property is not limited to land. In light of the debate raised by Juju, that's very interesting. Because if my interpretation of Section 25 is correct, then government may undertake several measures in line with my reading of Section 25 to ensure equitable access to South Africa's natural resources and other property that's not limited to land. Now, I think the reasons as to why those vested interests in property would argue that Section 25 is a property clause, what baffles me is why then those should be in the know. The majority party in government, the majority party in parliament, does not understand that actually Section 25 gives the money for land reform. That lack of understanding of Section 25 has led to a situation whereby we have the kind of confusion and confused public debate about nationalization and so on. Whereas there's already a very clear provision about what should happen to South Africa's natural resources in terms of equitable distribution and how that can be done. Another interesting section in the property clause, I'm calling it that for now, is that provision in Section 6, which basically says communities of persons whose rights to tenure is secure, then may have access to equitable redress and through an act of parliament. Now, this is where the question of chiefly control comes in. Basically, large numbers, between 15 and 22 million South Africans in the former homeland areas, do not have secure tenure because past laws basically meant that those people in the former homelands could not, for example, have private tenure, private title, freehold title as a form of property. They could only have land under a communal regime. Now, the way that communal regime was interpreted was not in terms of pre-colonial systems, because pre-colonial systems ensured that within communal tenure, there were defined rights and there were layers of rights that were clearly defined. It was clear what your private space was, what the communal space was, who could enter which space and which rights, who had rights to which space. However, apartheid interfered with those systems in ways that gave unaccountable powers to traditional leaders and also to the state, so people could be moved even within the former homelands, even within the communal tenure system. Such that now, as a result, there's actually large numbers of people with informal land rights which are not legally protected, which are not legally defined. When government attempted to put a law to address this anomaly, it was a law that was passed in 2004 called the Communal Land Rights Act. In 2010, in May, was it last year or 2011? It was last year. In May last year, the Constitutional Court declared that Communal Land Rights Act to be unconstitutional in its entirety. Now, in its decision, the Constitutional Court did not go to the substantive arguments as to why that law is unconstitutional in its entirety. It was declared unconstitutional because Parliament followed the wrong procedure to pass the law. The procedure Parliament followed did not include for consultation, did not include space for consultation with provinces as well as the public. So on that basis, it was inadequate public consultation. However, if the Constitutional Court had not decided that way, there are still a number of substantive issues that had to be debated. For example, critics of the Act, in my view, convincingly argued that that Act failed to meet what Section 25(6) required to secure tenure in communal areas, because what it did was to turn tribal authorities into land administration committees. Now, if you take into account what government has done to give unaccountable powers to traditional leaders after 1994, then the control of land by these tribal authorities turned into land administration committees would mean that many people would be vulnerable, and already communities are being subject to eviction, particularly in Limpopo and the Northwest, where there are significant mining deposits, and therefore mining companies enter into deals with traditional leaders in ways that undermine the security of tenure for large numbers of rural communities. What is also interesting about Section 6 is how it must be read together with the provisions in the Constitution for the recognition of traditional leaders, for the recognition of customary law. Now, there's a big debate there, because the Constitution recognizes traditional leaders, recognizes customary law. However, it does not define the role that they must have. It also does not define what customary law says. However, what it says is that both traditional leadership and customary law must be subject to the Constitution. I think that's a useful guide to a court to interpret what that role and status would be. However, arguably, in the work we do here, the Justice of the Gender Unit, arguably, other laws, such as the Traditional Leadership Act, actually militate against the Constitution, because they give, again, like the other state did, unaccountable powers to traditional leaders, including over control over land, and even in ways that undermine Section 25(6) of the Constitution, which, in my view, should be about land reform, and is also saying there should be secure tenure. The other thing to critique with regards to Section 25, which many on the left have made, I agree at times I don't agree with this critique, it's that reference to 19 June 1913. I think it's correct when the left says you can't serve such a deity because by 1913, already most of the land was dispossessed. In fact, we already had the homelands by then, even if they were called reserves. I think that's fair to say. However, an argument against that, which I think is also fair, is an argument that says, even if there's this deadline, that deadline does not stop government redistributing land in a way that benefits and redress the situation quite significant, such that the date of 1913 is actually insignificant. However, we have not had a state that has actually redistributed land in ways that it can be done. What explains this? As I've implied up to now, government has opted for a willing buyer, willing seller principle. And in the public domain, there is this idea that willing buyer, willing seller is mandated by the Constitution. Now, that's a huge barrier in the debate because no one has actually dared to stand up and say, no, the willing buyer, willing seller principle is not mandated by the Constitution. And government will need to buy this. The second reason, in my view, which is what my FD actually covers, is the policy options government opted for when it comes to economic policy and when it comes to agriculture. When it came to economic policy, when it came to agriculture, we opted for integration into the global economy, for an export-oriented economy, and in terms of that logic, that meant we must open up, we must liberalize, we must deregulate. Agriculture was regulated in this country for close to a century. That regulation meant that commercial farmers could actually develop, they had the space to do so. By the way, that form of regulation, that form of state support and subsidies was not unique to apartheid South Africa. It was the case well over, including in the US, including in the EU. This is a finding made by Hajun Chang and a team of 20 researchers who were commissioned by the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN in a very important report they released last year, which shows that the policies of liberalization, of deregulation of agriculture, do not work to support redistributive land reform, do not work to ensure that the country can produce food sustainably. What has worked are versions of what the apartheid state had done when it comes to agriculture. Effective support, marketing boards, trusts, subsidies, provision of transport infrastructure, provision of storage infrastructure, even provision of processing infrastructure for many of the agricultural products. And what we did in 1996, in fact, it's actually amazing. Clive Van Niekerk, who was then the Minister of Agriculture on behalf of the Nationalist Party in the new government, was resistant to complete deregulation, to complete liberalization, because he was still accountable to a farming constituency. The ANC committee in parliament took away the law he was actually blocking, and basically said, we will deregulate, we will liberalize in one foul swoop. This was in 1996. By doing that, we handed over billions of rands of public property that was in the silos into private commercial farms. Now, how do you redistribute land on the one hand, and then on the other hand, you take what was built by the public purse, which now could have been made accessible to the new farmers. That's the second problem, in my view. Agricultural policy and economic policy, which has been described as neoliberal, which basically then militated against a redistributive land reform. There are many other problems that speak to the capacity of the state, particularly the Department of Land Affairs, where basically there has not been institutional memory, there has not been enough planners, or even people who can negotiate capably with farmers and so on. But many other problems speak to how post-apartheid policies continue to reinforce the geography of apartheid, which I think the citation that Michelle was citing speak to. I've spoken quite a bit. I just want to check how much time I have.
5 minutes.
Okay, no, that's fine. So basically, the problems of land reform, as I'm saying, have to be blamed on a misinterpretation of Section 25 on the dominant economic and agricultural policy, as well as on the capacity of the state. I don't have time to go through the detail of these last two problems. I do want to make a few controversial points as I conclude. This is a book called Zimbabwe's Land Reform, Myths and Realities, by a team of researchers led by Ian Schoons. Ian Schoons is a British academic at the Institute for Development Studies in, I think, in Oxford. That book basically says, yeah, it's fine, you may have violated land rights and so on, and not land rights, but human rights in Zimbabwe. They're not saying it's fine. They're saying, let's take that as a given. However, let's go through what has happened after land was redistributed through the controversial land reform program. What they show there in the book is a case, several case studies in the Mashingo district, where they show that actually, that once space was opened up to violate the so-called inviolate, principle of property rights that cannot be violated, ordinary people took over land, and ordinary people produced once they got land. In fact, they've got figures of how the silos in Mashingo were full throughout the 2007 to 2010 period, which was when most people took over land. Now, that story speaks to what political economists and historians of land reform have always said. It is rare in history that there would be a successful land reform without a revolutionary upheaval in society. That may shock many of us. There's not a single case, in fact, in the 19th, the 20th century, where there has been successful land reform without some kind of social upheaval in society. I'm not calling for that, but I think it is telling. I think it is telling that this, that actually is recorded by historians and political economists of land reform, that you won't find such a situation. Even in the US-led situations, there was actually a massive mobilization and massive struggles by the landless putting pressure on the state. This brings me to the final example that I want to quote for us to think about, the case of Brazilian land reform and the constitution. After the end of the military dictatorship in 1985 in Brazil, a new constitution was put in place in 1988. That constitution, like ours, allows expropriation of large landholdings. But also, more than ours, that constitution says any land that does not fulfill a social function or is considered unproductive may be expropriated. Now, that raises a whole range of possibilities. And in fact, landless people in Brazil, through the MST, the Landless People's Movement, have actually used that provision of the Constitution, the social function of land, to redistribute land much more than the state has been able to. Following the 1988 Constitution, there was also then a law on land reform that then said any land, piece of land, larger than 160 hectares would be defined as a large landholding. And if it's not used, government would confiscate and pay compensation and then redistribute. However, like our government, the Brazilian government of the late 80s, early 1990s, failed to implement this constitutional and legal provision. So then what the MST did was actually to plan strategies of occupation of land. Something similar to the military veterans, but less militarized. Actually, it would be landless communities. They would mark out on the map which farms they regard as unproductive or socially useless, in line with the Brazilian constitution. After they've marked them out, they take months to train these landless people in production. They develop plans for these farms, where the schools would be, where the cultural production would be, where the clinic would be, where the housing would be, once they've occupied. After they've finished those plans, after they are convinced that these landless people are trained and are capable of running productive entities, after they've occupied and taken over the land, what they then did was then to instigate a system of legal support, because they would now then go to a piece of land, at times armed, at times unarmed, and basically engage in some serious battles with the landowners. And then when the state comes to evict them, they will then invoke this section of the Constitution. We can prove to you that this piece of land is socially unuseful or is unproductive. And once they have done that, then the state was forced to then follow the process which was defined in the law. in most cases, because they had built a system of preparation, because they had built a system of support with lawyers, they were ready to go to court and win many cases. As a result of that, disciplined form of mass mobilization, there has actually been significant land distribution in Brazil through this system, much more than the state has, because the state system in Brazil, like our system here, is based on a willing, viable set of principles. Now, I think these lessons from Mashingo and from Brazil show that in South Africa, unfortunately, our mobilization of the rural poor, of the landless, is open to abuse by the likes of Juju, because the likes of Juju are actually not about the preparation of the poor so that they become social agents of history. And I think for me, the absence of a social agent that can take forward the land debate in South Africa is a critical absence in our debates. I hope this makes sense. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Before I take questions, there's one axis that I've always sort of also tried to analyze the landfall question around, and I'm interested in your view, which is the deprioritization of rural issues, other than in some idyllic agrarian sense, and the prioritization of what are perceived to be more urban issues. And therefore, we've had much more litigation and more success around housing questions and then related services that, in an urbanized, concentrated community and society, it may be easier to mobilize and litigate and find lawyers that will be prepared to take the cases. So I'm interested in your view, you finished with comments about the level of mobilization and organization in South Africa, and I'm interested in whether you think the urban-rural divide explains it to some extent or plays a part.
I agree entirely with your observation. There has not been, for example, the critique I would throw to my colleagues on the left when they say amend the property clause. I say maybe there is value in amending the property clause if you want to, for example, include the Brazilian provision on social functionality of land. But before you do that, test the property clause in the courts. There has not been a single case that seeks to challenge the Geldenhuis formula. So though I agree with you entirely, so that's at the level of what civil society can do through the courts, through mass mobilization and so on. But at another level, if you look at the 2006 Special Development Framework, National Special Development Framework that government uses to determine how it allocates public resources, that Special Development Framework reinforces an urban bias. Because basically, the 26 key economic centers of the country are the ones that receive the largest allocations of public resources. What does that do to the former homelands? What does that do to the Boland district and so on? Because public resources are directed to the urban areas. This explains partly why the budgets for both land reform and for agriculture have actually been minimal. A calculation by cultural economists at the University of Stellenbosch shows that the budget for agriculture, cultural support of 1988 still surpasses our budget today that we provide to support agriculture. So that just shows that there's a bias against rural areas in budget allocations.
Are there any questions, comments?
You mentioned earlier that there were 60,000 claims at the outset. Can you just give us a brief summary on where we're at in addressing those claims? And there is, I understand, I recall, a deadline that we're trying to meet. And just refresh our
Okay. I forgot the name of the act, but it set the deadline of 31 December 1998 by which people who were disposed of land must have made claims, must have submitted claims. So that deadline is long and gone. According to government, I think it's actually about 79,000 claims that were lodged, just above 79,000.
Now, government has dealt with most urban claims. What is remaining is the last 10,000, which are complicated because they are huge rural claims. What would happen, for example, in a place like Limpopo, a Venda community would have been moved forcibly in the early 1930s, and then government would try to occupy that land, the former government, to occupy that land with white farmers. And then some of the land would be occupied, but not all. And then a Sotho Kompeti community would come and occupy. So now both the Venda and the Sotho communities have made such claims on the same piece of land. So now that is the complexity that is left behind in the last 10,000 claims. Government had then set its own self-imposed deadline several times. The last one is 2014. And I have no doubt that we will go past 2014 without having resolved many of those claims, partly because of capacity in the Land Claims Commission, but also because of the court-based process of restitution, because every claim has to be validated by the Land Claims Court, or where there's a dispute, the Land Claims Court has to then resolve that dispute. But then another problem is budgets. The Land Claims Commission has basically run without adequate budgets throughout its years of existence from 1996. So actually, we're going to remain with this problem for very long.
Could you briefly explain the institutional division of labor between, so I lodge a claim, what happens to it? So we can understand where they're sitting in the process.
Basically, you would lodge a claim There are three critical institutions to deal with restitution. It's the Department of Land Affairs. It's now called, I don't know the new name, after 2009, but the old Department of Land Affairs. And then under the department, a law put in place a commission for the restitution of land claims. It's normally called the Land Claims Commission. And then that law also set up the Land Claims Court. So basically, most of these 80,000 claims, would have submitted their claims to the Land Claims Commission. And then the Land Claims Commission, with support at times from the Department of Land Affairs, would investigate each claim. They would even call historians or even legal people to help investigate the claims. That's what makes the process very long, because each claim has to be investigated in detail and then gazetted once it's considered to be valid. After it's gazetted, also there's space and opportunity for the landowner to then put a counter-argument. And then if they can settle, then it just goes to the court for validation. If there's no settlement, if there's a dispute, then it becomes a court case. That's a quick summary. That leaves out a lot of detail.
What happens, my brother's a farmer, and some people are paying on his property. He can't take up any loans, he can't do anything at the moment, he can't sell his property until the claim is actually investigated and found to be valid. And apparently, there weren't any people living in the area, and these people have just sort of got on a bandwagon and made a claim for the whole area. Now what happens if, for example, his claim is invalid? Can he then get some kind of compensation for, the loss of development on his property, his farm?
That's quite a complex one. look, this is where I agree with AgriSA. And these problems in our land reform system actually cause a whole range of uncertainties, not just for farmers, but even for government itself, even for the beneficiaries of land reform. If I was government, what I would do is actually to put a portion of land bank money aside to enable continuous investment if a farmer has to continue producing whilst the land is under claim, whilst the claim is being investigated. Now, a typical private commercial bank is not going to give a loan, as you say. So if we're in advance, and I think government thinking in advance and with capacity, there's already a public institution that you can use. Because either way, whether the land claim is successful or not, the land would remain productive. Why has government not provided funds through the land bank to ensure that there's continuous investment? So for me, okay, this adds to the other problems I was saying, because in many cases, you do have land claims that are complex and require extensive investigation, but with a land claims commission and the Department of Land Affairs that does not have capacity, you then end up in these bogged down processes that take forever to resolve. Whether your brother can lay, can seek some compensation for loss of investment, unfortunately, I'm not a lawyer at all. I think, though, that in terms of... let me not venture into stuff I do not know. Let me give you...
Very dark.
Yeah. Look, the courts are quite conservative themselves. No, I'll come to that. So once Heldenais said that formula, it was not difficult to see why many judgments after that would follow that logic. So even when it comes to judges themselves, it would take a bold judge such as that one to actually question the basis for Heldenais to have reached his conclusion. So unfortunately, that has not happened. There has not been a case of progressive judicial activism, of constitutional judicial activism that goes beyond what the judges know. That goes beyond precedents that have been set. That is very rare in this country. When it comes to civil society, the landless, and others, I think there are two factors. There's general ignorance, there's a general lack of critical consciousness about what the Constitution says. Partly because of government failure, then people seem to be rejectionist of the Constitution. We have a Constitution that's claimed to be powerful and wonderful, and yet we're still hungry. So then people do not seek to use the Constitution as a transformative document. People rather opt for a situation that disempowers them. There's a huge task amongst many of us to ensure that there's a critical understanding of what the Constitution provides for and how it can be used. This is why then the example of the Treatment Action Campaign is very useful, because it has used the Constitution and general principles about holding government accountable to maximum effect. That has not been used very much outside of AIDS. It has not been used at all when it comes to land, when it comes to rural issues. This then brings me to the last point about the historical weakness of rural mobilization. The struggle against apartheid was primarily urban, and rural people have always been poorly and weakly mobilized. The last moment in South African history where you had significant mobilization was when the peasants rose up in 1960 in Pondoland. But after that, there's actually been, despite the massive votes for the ANC in the rural areas, but actually there's not any significant organization. Right now, last week, our unit had a national workshop on the Traditional Courts Bill, which is something else that's also going to violate people's rights in rural areas. What was shocking to us as a unit was the extent to which people are affected by these laws, but they do not know, rural people do not know how to connect the dots and where to start to actually make their claims. So that's another problem. Because if people were organized, there would be a question, why can't we go to lawyers? And once they go to lawyers, all sorts of questions arise. Whereas in Khayelitsha, you cannot have open toilets for too long without noise coming up. In rural areas, you can have such stuff for far too long without anyone actually rising up to make adequate noise.
Why don't you just take one final
text
back,
but
it could be brief.
Sorry, with regards to their article, I know in our road there's a mass hysteria about people coming into the roads and growing property and property prices going down and all that. Could you maybe briefly explain whether it's possible that they are making
there's a very live and active Facebook group, Occupy Rondebosch Common. I followed it, and look, man, it's What people are trying to do is basically to say public spaces should be open to the public, they're not just talking about the Rondebosch Common. They're making the point about all of Cape Town. A few years ago, you may remember, a struggle over access to land for housing in Hout Bay. In Hout Bay, there are enough hectares to ensure that the poor are properly integrated into the Hout Bay space and not confined to Imizamoe to Hangberg. So they're just using the symbolism of the Rondebosch Common to say public spaces in Cape Town should be made available to the poor in ways that integrate society. Because if we continue to protect the dog walkers only to access the Rondebosch Common, then we reintroduce apartheid geography. And that logic needs to be challenged. It may be uncomfortable, it may raise questions, but I think actually if I was a resident of Rondebosch of a different shade and color, I would go there to express my concerns publicly. The comrades who are mobilizing that occupation are actually quite reasonable and quite open to discussion. And they have said very clearly, this is not a party political issue for exploitation by political parties for narrow ends. So if you stay in Rondebosch, I would actually suggest that you start first and see the debates on that Facebook page, the Occupy Rondebosch Common Facebook page, and see if you can make contact with them.
I think there's one final question.
Yes.
I used to live in Rondebosch, so.
This is one of the areas where the public gets confused. Maybe there are some foreigners buying our land. Maybe they push up prices. But that would happen primarily in Kemps Bay and not where there's massive land. Look, you may have a few farms bought by Parmalat and so on, but it's not a major issue. However, what government has done as a result of this ignorance about the state of land affairs in the country was to put together a commission led by Professor Shedrack Guto about 4 years ago to advise government on what to do to regulate foreign ownership and buying of land. The commission report sat on Thabo's desk until he got out of power, and then now Gugile Mthunzi, the minister, has used elements of that report to put in place a new law, which is before Parliament in this session. That law basically says there must be regulation. We must protect South African ownership. We must encourage foreign investment. So we're not excluding foreign ownership, but there will be a process to be followed. It can't just be now a process whereby anyone can buy land as long as they can show the money and an ID or some other form of legal identification. So the government is moving towards regulation. It's not moving towards excluding foreign ownership. I don't think that's a major issue. The major issue is land inequities as we have them, as we have inherited from apartheid. We shouldn't be confused by noise that misleads us. I think it's misleading us to actually target foreigners when it comes to land ownership. You can have a fair system that encourages investment, that encourages participation in the economy across the board in ways that benefit even the poor. So for me, I would look for that kind of solution.
I wondered if you were aware that there are 27 million hectares of unused arable land in South Africa that came out of frost and some of the frost in America. But the municipalities are beginning to understand the consequences of this, and they are now charging punitive rates on unused land. Now, if you take that fact to its logical conclusion, it won't be long before that those 27 million hectares will have no market value at all, because they will have a rates charge which does away with all the capital land.
That's why then we need a social function of land clause.
That is, yeah, that is a social function. Yeah.
And then we can invoke something else, because what the municipalities are doing is basically an ad hoc thing that just addresses their immediate cash flow crisis.
No, I don't think it's got anything to do
with it. So for me...
No, they're worried. They've got people who are not employed. And when land gets to the point where you've only got to rent on it, it's not interesting to the speculators who are now keeping it out of the market. Mm. It's interesting to somebody who wants to go and build their wine farm there. So, yeah, I don't think it's to do with money. I think it's to do with getting people off.
Look, I think my view is this. I think that municipalities are using the Municipal Rates Act to basically cover some shortfall by charging exorbitant rates from unused land. Insofar as whether those rates will encourage use of land, I think that's another debate altogether, because there are reasons.
Why do you say that? Sorry.
Government would, when the law was passed a few years ago in Parliament, government was saying these municipal rates will encourage use of land. When they say so, what they actually ignore is the reasons for why farmers are not able to use the land. The lack of public support, the lack of public subsidies, and the expensive nature of agriculture and other land-based activities means that many farmers actually cannot afford to use the land. And then the municipal rates do not cover those issues at all. All they are saying is punitive, as you are saying, just punish unused land. But actually, that does not address the nature of investment required from the public and other sectors to encourage the use of land.
Yeah, productive. Sorry, you can carry on spread off, that was 75 rand. So I'm happy to do that, I mean, just in order to for everybody else. I just want to raise one or two small points. I had the privilege this afternoon of listening to Chief Justice Schatzholson speak at the British Law Conference. And there's an interesting linkage between what he said and you said. I'm not entirely sure that he raised anything that you said that you would be surprised by that either. but here's where the link comes. What he said was he was trying to argue something that Michelle and I had been debating and which we want to conclude on Friday. Discussing with you, so I'm not going to go into it all, about the attack on the judiciary. And he posed two questions. One, of course, is why is there attack on the judiciary? And secondly, is it about the judiciary or about the constitution? The complaints. If you ask yourself, is the judiciary in tune with the constitution, then the problem isn't the judiciary, but the constitution. Now, it's true that Mazimuk has quite correctly pointed out to the Helderness Doctrine, which in fairness, if I could just say one thing, is by and large being the jurisprudence of the land claims.
Yeah.
And I've never quite understood either. Your questions intrigue me too. Intrigue me too as to why, in fact, that has been as retentive as it is within the land claims. But I've got my views on them, but I'm not sure I want to share them with polite company. What I do want to say is that within the broader constitutional framework, there's enough jurisprudence within the Constitutional Court to suggest that the willing buyer, willing seller principle cannot possibly exist. And what's therefore important, and it's been raised here, is that our constitutional clause, 25, and thank you so much for taking us through that clause, as carefully as you did, reveals two things. Unbelievable ignorance of that clause by the public, by the politicians. Certainly Mr. Malema and his lot have been completely abusing the idea that you have to get rid of the clause in order to attain a significant transformation of land in South Africa. I think it's been exposed tonight as a complete nonsense. And the real question, therefore, is maybe we as the courts have not done our job properly, but there's no question if you listen again to seeing there's a massive destruction between the structures which have been placed in relation to programs in relation to land and what that constitutional clause actually prompts. And that's something we should be really worried about, because it may well be that the last time that we had real land issues was the Pondoland, and very significantly when I was researching that a long, long time ago, the book that I first read was Gordon Mbeki's book on the peasant chattels, all those many years ago about the size of that's how long ago that is. But the fact is, I'm not so sure that we can simply fob this off as if there will never be another social land movement to deal with these questions, given what we've heard this evening. And I'm not so sure that is correct, that indeed what we heard from Aziruku this evening, and indeed the introduction from the show, doesn't raise profound questions about how do we close the gap between what the Constitution, particularly Clause 25, promised, and what in fact is happening in the reality. And that raises really important questions which we've been posing throughout this week in relation to the cause. Now, before I thank Matthew formally, let's say that we've chosen two very critical and important components which ultimately challenge the constitutional framework as we set out the first stage of our Shoah Monday. Tonight's been that, and that maybe is something which is broader, more difficult to grasp. I hope not after what has been an extraordinarily illuminating event. But I also want to say that tomorrow night we deal with something absolutely directly, which is the issue of the secrecy bill and our rights to be informed. And of course, if we don't have a right to be informed, we can't hear what's being spoken about tonight. So tomorrow is an equally important debate that hopefully we can share with you, and hopefully people will participate in, because this is your problem as much as it's ours in relation to whether we're going to get this running bill or not. And then finally, we'll finish up on Friday engaging with you about Quo Vadis, where do we go? But it finally remains for me to say thank you so much. And it's a really important contribution. It is going to be on a podcast, which I'm delighted, so other people will be able to get the benefits that we've had. Thank you for coming. Thank you for sharing these thoughts with us. And I think everybody's been enormously beneficiary as well.
Thank you.